This is Bloomberg Business of Sports.
The world's changing, and what are things we can do to transform our business and engage our fans globally in different ways?
People are using their name and likeness to create more opportunities, more stakes in companies.
In order to turn the organization around, we had to turn it around not only just on the baseball operations side, but on the business operations side.
Football and any other sport is very difficult, but I like to broaden my horizons and be able to expand.
Sports need to be consumed live, and that's a big competitive advantage for intellectual property holders of sports content in the media landscape.
Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jason Kelly.
And I'm Mike Lynch.
And I'm Michael Barr. Every week at this time, plus Mondays and Wednesdays, we explore the big money issues in the world of sports.
And today, we got a jam-packed show, fellas. We're going to hear some of my interview with soccer star, president, and co-owner of the soccer club Inter Miami. Yeah, we're talking about David Beckham, a wide-ranging conversation. We talked a little bit about the MLS. We talked a little World Cup. Even talked a little Super League.
As a fan, I know how important it is to have fans in the stadium and supporting. And that's why these decisions that get made in sport are so critical, because it changes people's lives and it changes people's perspective.
Plus, we speak with Gabe Feldman, director of the Tulane Sports Law Program, about the Supreme Court's landmark ruling on compensation for college athletes and the latest on the NIL legislation.
It is going to be, I don't think this is an overstatement, the biggest change in college athlete rights in our lifetime.
All of that is coming up on the Bloomberg Business of Sports show. But first, let's talk about some of the top stories of the week. And we're not going to go far here, guys, because the top story of the week in the business of sports really is the NCAA. And it's amazing how many people are weighing in and, candidly, how consistent it is. Earlier in the week, our colleague David Westin spoke with Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee. That's one of the states that is adopting name, image, and likeness legislation that goes into effect this coming week. Here's what she had to say.
When you look at the amount of money that is involved in college athletics, and you look at the NCAA and the way they have really taken advantage of the contracts with networks and with these schools, but you don't have anything accruing to the student. And we think it's important for them to own their name, image, and likeness.
That is Senator Marsha Blackburn speaking with David Westin earlier this week on Balance of Power. Lynchy, I think it's fair to say we saw a dam not just crack, but really break this week between the Supreme Court and then July 1 being such a key date, the NCAA, Mark Emmert coming out and basically saying, all right, we're going to put some rules into place, at least on a temporary basis, while we wait for Congress. This is the biggest change in college sports we've seen in our lifetime.
Absolutely. And this is going to be a bridge. Emmert is working very, very swiftly, because when July 1st comes, there are a number of states ready to go, including Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Texas, Mississippi, and New Mexico. Big, big college football states and college basketball states. And this is really going to undercut the NCAA's grip on these teams. It's just going to be the beginning of the end. And I can't wait for our conversation later in this show with Gabe Feldman to hear what he has to say, especially with Justice Kavanaugh coming out, who's a conservative. And plus, it was a unanimous decision, 9-0.
Not a lot of unanimity about anything these days, Michael Barr. All right, so Barr, give us the fans' perspective here. I mean, you love sports in all shapes and sizes and stripes. Does this change potentially the way you look at college sports going forward?
No, because first of all, what is going to change for me is that, and like Lynchy said, you got, you know, Texas and Alabama, and they're all getting ready to go. The problem is schools that I love, the University of Michigan, they're not ready to go yet. So now what happens? Because that's not a small university. That's a big university there. So I want to see how all this is going to get cleaned up. But, yes, I say this also to the students to take advantage of the educational incentives that they would get. You know, because a lot of these college students, the odds to make it to the pros is very small.
Right.
So take advantage of it now. If you can get some help for your college education, do it. And I hope that helps you succeed in other parts of their line.
And we're going to talk with Gabe Feldman about this. I mean, it's important, I think, as we examine the economics of this, to understand that there are some economics that are going to change on the educational side, at least pretty immediately, owing to this Alston case, what's known as the Alston case, that the Supreme Court ruled on. But the name, image, and likeness piece is massive because, you know, you're going to have a situation where everything from a big brand, an apparel maker, can do a deal with a college student to, you know, the local car dealership or the local sandwich shop, you know, basically being able to say, you know, this star player at Boston College, you know, loves our sandwiches or is buying a car where he drives our type of vehicle. So it's going to be fascinating to see. I think there's real money. I think you're going to have an ecosystem that's really going to be created here, an all-new ecosystem, some of which, Lynchy, as you know, has been sort of a shadow ecosystem for a long time. And part of what's going to happen is this is going to be, at least at the beginning, hopefully, on the up and up.
Well, 460,000 student-athletes participate in sports in the NCAA. 2% or less than 2% will play professional sports.
Yeah.
So that sort of, you know, supports the theory, grab what you can and grab it now. Come on down to Ernie Bach Chevrolet and Trevor Lawrence will sign an autograph and take a picture with your family for $25.
Just think, like, after you kicked that winning field goal, Lynchy, like, you would have been in heavy demand, you know? Like, you would have, you know, you would have been the star of all the – you probably were the star of all the bars there in Cambridge. But, you know, could have made some cheddar there. All right. So let's move over.
I get to see a commercial, Lynchy, for Windows R Us, because we broke one on this one.
Yeah, exactly. Lynchy for the win. In any case, here's another thing that I think is fascinating and catching all of our attention this week, which is Major League Baseball, kind of a gang that can't shoot straight, I got to say. I mean, they have found themselves embroiled in this insane controversy to some extent. And it's not an insane controversy as much as, I should say, how it is being handled. And Trevor Bauer, Cy Young Award winner, of course, from last year, he was a guest on this show last year as well. He's got a YouTube channel. Here's what he had to say about how the league is dealing with this quite literal sticky situation.
I do think it's good that they're doing something about it finally. I don't think it's smart to do it in the middle of the season. I think it's ridiculous that they have chosen to do that after basically just lying to players and teams and everybody, saying we're not doing anything about it this year. Nothing's going to change. Just do what you do. It's frustrating.
It was all in the sigh. All you had to hear was the sigh there. Lynchy, in some ways, I got to tell you, it is well-intentioned. I agree with what Trevor Bauer said. I think they do need to do something about it. But, man, you watch the drama that's literally unfolding in games this week and managers calling for pitchers to essentially be searched and the pitchers, shall we say, not reacting well to that suggestion. What happened here? What went wrong?
Well, you look at some of the numbers. When they started on Monday doing this and inspecting pitchers, the league-wide batting average was .237, the lowest since 1968. We've already had six no-hitters here. The record for no-hitters in one season is 7. So there's obviously a great imbalance here between the pitchers and the hitters. And the Sports Illustrated article, I think, really just opened everybody's eyes when it was written that 80 to 90% of pitchers use some type of substance on the baseball. So it has prompted all kinds of reactions. You probably saw Max Scherzer and Joe Girardi the other night with Washington and Philadelphia. Oof. And unfortunately, this has become the most exciting part about baseball. No one is all year long is talking about any pitcher or any hitter, save for Ohtani out with the Angels out in Anaheim. This is all anybody's talking about in Major League Baseball, is the doctored baseballs and the reaction from the hitters and the pitchers and the managers as well.
Yeah, I mean, meanwhile, if you think about it, and I now have waited many minutes into the show to talk about the Atlanta Hawks, I would just like to...
there you go.
Meanwhile,
49.
As you have, you know, an incredible sort of series of athletic performance happening in the NBA playoffs, i.e., e.g., Young comma Trey. This is all we're talking about, to Lynchy's point, Barr, when it comes to baseball. If you're baseball, if you're Rob Manfred, these are not the headlines you want at this point. It's not good for the fans.
It's going to be a big mess, and they got to figure out what they want to do. If they want to check a pitcher when he comes out, do it then before he starts pitching, because in the middle of the game, that's going to be a mess.
Well, we'll see, you know, ultimately how this affects the bottom line in terms of either fan attendance, in terms of viewership. I mean, this will play out through the numbers. You know, the economics of all of these sports are fragile. We know that. We know that from last year. And baseball, we also know, more than any other sport, really depends on fan engagement for its revenues. So I am not optimistic at this moment about where baseball is. We're coming up on collective bargaining later this year. All signs point to a deal, and yet this sort of acrimony doesn't bode well for the future of the business of baseball. Well, let's get back to that big story of the week. The NCAA college sports, they are changing. There is no doubt about it. And the big news this week really was around the Supreme Court. And of course, looking ahead to July 1, which is a big, big date when it comes to name, image, and likeness. No one knows this better, and I say that with a lot of confidence, than Gabe Fellman. He is the director of the Tulane Sports Law Program. He's the associate provost for NCAA compliance. Plus, he's a fellow podcaster. He's got Between the Lines, a podcast about sports and the law. Gabe, I said to you before we came on the air, you're the hardest working man in Hollywood this week. You are heavy in demand, so it's really good to get some time with you. You know, we know the news of this week, but distill down for us, what does it mean in the short and midterm?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. It's an important question because it would seem pretty obvious based on all the headlines that this seems to be the beginning of the end for the NCAA, and it may be, but in the short term, this was a really narrow decision by the Supreme Court, and it was narrow because there was only a really narrow issue in front of it, and that narrow issue was whether the NCAA as a whole, all the schools in the NCAA, were permitted under antitrust law to restrict a subset of compensation to college athletes, and that subset of compensation were benefits related to education. So laptops, science equipment, musical equipment, post-eligibility scholarships and internships, and some cash for academic performance. And the Supreme Court said there is no basis under antitrust law for the NCAA to restrict that. It's illegal under antitrust law, so they are enjoined, right? They're stopped, they're legally prevented from enforcing those rules, which means starting really 2 days ago that the NCAA could no longer agree to put those restrictions in place. What it doesn't mean, though, and I think this is what people are either assuming it means or hoping it means, it doesn't mean that the NCAA can't continue to restrict those payments that are unrelated to education, right, like pay for play or even pay for name, image, and likeness. So that was untouched by the nine justices. Obviously, Justice Kavanaugh wrote a concurring opinion that said, hey, if it were my choice, I would blow up everything and say it's all illegal. But that was just one justice. What the Supreme Court said is that these limited subset of restrictions on education benefits, that's illegal. It's now up to the conferences or the schools to decide what the rules are. So we know what they can't do. We just don't know what they will do. Right? So we know the NCAA will no longer agree to those rules association-wide, but it's now left to be determined what they will do going forward.
There are a lot of concerns because of this ruling that this is going to separate the schools from the haves and the have-nots, the smaller schools, because the bigger schools can offer more perks to the students. I'd just like to get your thoughts and weigh in on what you think.
Yeah, it's definitely a concern that's been expressed. It was an argument that the NCAA made early on in the litigation, and they've made it for the last several decades. And then they dropped it during the litigation. And I think they dropped it because there's a general recognition now that the big schools are already so far separated from the small schools that nobody is going to choose to go to, no offense to Alabama State, but Alabama State over Alabama because you can get a better laptop at Alabama State. If you go to Alabama, you're already getting better perks. Those perks are in the facilities, they're in the coaching staff, they're in the weight room. they're in the meals you get. There's already that massive gap. I don't think this narrow subset is going to change anything. If anything, it will just mean that all schools have the opportunity to provide more education-related benefits to college athletes. And if that does lead to an education-related arms race, I'd take that over a facilities-based arms race. So I think ultimately this is good news for college athletes. I don't think it's bad news for colleges in the short term. I think the problem for the NCAA is that this may be in the beginning of a series of antitrust cases that they lose, because although the remedy in this case was narrow, I think the reason the NCAA is worried about it and critics of the NCAA are celebrating it is because the Supreme Court said, despite the NCAA's arguments, the NCAA is subject to antitrust law just like every other industry in the country. They don't get special treatment. We're not giving them any deference. They have to fight all of their rules under antitrust law just like everybody else does.
So, Gabe, following up on that, I think there's roughly 1,100 universities and schools and colleges in the NCAA. It's safe to say the majority of them don't want to or can't afford to pay for any of these perks. Do you see maybe creating a new division, as Mike said, that between the haves and the have-nots? Or don't want to?
I don't think that would happen over these education benefits, because, again, I just don't think it's going to have that much of an impact on recruiting. I think it's going to be a drop in the bucket compared to name, image, and likeness. I think it's going to be a drop in the bucket compared to the facilities, compared to the coaching there. And so I think it's the smaller schools that already have the much smaller facility will continue to offer smaller education benefits. I just think it's going to be consistent. I don't think it's going to lead to a rift between the have and the have-nots. If that happens, and it may, and we may have the Power Five or the Power Two or Three break away and form a quasi-professional or just a different league, I don't think that'll happen over this particular case. It might be the next case. If the schools are allowed to pay beyond the education expenses so they can offer $100,000 to the athlete to come to the school, that would make it truly unsustainable for the small schools. It's not as if these small schools are not already providing education benefits to the athletes. This is just saying you can't limit it. But there's nothing in the opinion, actually the opinion says the conferences can continue to do so. So the Ivy League can say, no, we're not going to allow our schools to pay athletes $5,000 for academic achievement awards. I think those continue in place, and I don't think we'll notice much of a difference in the way the game is played or how the conferences are structured.
You know, Gabe, what's so fascinating, and especially I would imagine for someone like you who's followed this for so long, is it is all sort of happening at once in many ways. I mean, you sort of can't make up the fact that, you know, the Supreme Court this past week does this. You know, this coming week, July 1, is this sort of seminal moment where 19 states, I believe it is so far, you know, have these name, image, and likeness laws on the books. Sort of synthesize this for us. Help us understand, because the name, image, and likeness piece, and you and I have talked about this before, is potentially much more important economically, certainly in the short term. What's going to happen, especially now that the NCAA finally feels like, and I'm editorializing a little bit here, seems to be at least kind of getting its act together and saying, all right, okay, we're going to put some rules in place, but you're still waiting on Congress. Like, help us unpack this a little bit.
Yeah, I think you've touched on all the really important levers here. There has been congressional interest in this. There's obviously state interest. As you said, 19 laws will go into effect. For almost all states have at least introduced or are considering introducing legislation around name, image, and likeness. There is the Alston decision, and there's the NCAA itself has been meeting for the last year and a half to talk about this, and now it's all come to a head, and in part because the NCAA, I think now explicitly or admittedly, was waiting to see what the Supreme Court would say in Alston before they finalized their NIL rules. Now they have the decision, and it just happens to be a week before July 1st when the state laws will take effect. The NCAA appears to be saying, even if you're in a state that doesn't have a law that takes effect July 1, college athletes will have the right to make money off of their name, image, and likeness. And the schools just need to come up with their own policy. And there'll be some basic guidelines in place, but it's up to the schools to fill out the details. And really the two basic guidelines are, this can't be pay for play, and it can't be used as a recruiting inducement.
Right.
And presumably the schools won't be able to make the payments. So this is designed to allow third parties to pay athletes for the use of their name, image, and likeness, and the college athletes can hire representation. They can hire agents, marketing agents, someone to help them negotiate these deals, which means come July 1, college athletes all across the country will be allowed to do traditional endorsement deals with apparel companies. They'll be able to make appearances. They'll sign autographs for money. They can make money off of social media. They can promote camps or clinics that they're going to do. It is going to be, I don't think this is an overstatement, the biggest change in college athlete rights in our lifetimes. And as you said, it just so happens to be coming right after the Supreme Court has made maybe one of the biggest decisions, or I think probably the biggest decision around college sports. So they are related, but as we've talked about, that they're not directly related because the Supreme Court opinion does not talk about NIL. It's, again, it's just education-related benefits. NIL are not education-related benefits. The bigger change, as I was saying before, I think will be the college athlete's ability to monetize their name, image, and likeness. That's where I think the greater number of dollars will flow to college athletes, and I think that's the bigger step to greater rights for college athletes. I think this is all part of the same evolution that we're seeing college athletes have a larger voice and more economic freedom. And name, image, and likeness, in my mind, is the much bigger step than the education benefits that the Supreme Court just gave them.
And so as we wrap up here, Gabe, I mean, I have to ask you, and this is going back a ways, but again, you know this better than anybody, you know, as tends to happen in history, you know, things happen slowly and then all at once, as I think we have described well in this conversation. But why now, in your mind? I mean, knowing both the details but also kind of the atmospherics of this, why is this all happening now?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it is a little bit of a perfect storm where the underlying factor, I think, has just been the explosion of revenue in college sports and the billions of dollars that are being generated and the massive coaching salaries and spending on facilities. And, you know, you can go down the list of the gold-plated facilities and how much not only head coaches are making, but assistant coaches and strength trainers. And the benefits to college athletes have remained relatively flat. And that has troubled more and more people as the gap increases. And it's become a bipartisan issue. And I think people see it now as either an economic rights issue or a civil rights issue, because this predominantly affects, at least in FBS football and Division I basketball, Black athletes. And so whether you approach it as an economic rights issue, just let the market dictate it, or you approach this from a civil rights issue, either way you get to the same point, that college athletes deserve more rights. And I think the greatest example of that, or illustration of that, was the concurrence from Justice Kavanaugh, one of the most conservative justices on the Supreme Court, who just tore into the NCAA. And even said this is unfair to Black athletes. And, you know, it takes a lot, not to make a political statement here, but it takes a lot for a conservative justice to side on to rule on the side of labor.
Yeah.
And against what we would consider big business. And although that's not a binding opinion, I think that's pretty indicative of the shift we've seen publicly, that whether or not you love college sports, you think it's unfair the way college athletes are being treated, and that deference we're giving to the NCAA in, you know, at the expense of college athletes is no longer palatable to politicians, and we saw it's no longer palatable to the Supreme Court. So I think with just the sort of the push for more civil rights, everything we've seen in this country around racial equity, and all the money flowing in college sports. And then the last piece would just be the explosion of social media.
Yeah.
That if there
are
thousands of college students who are not athletes, who are monetizing their name, image, and likeness, it seems unfair to not allow the college athletes to do the same.
Yeah. Well, as always, I got a lot smarter hearing from you, and I know I speak on behalf of my co-hosts and our audience. Gabe Fellman, thank you so much. Director of the Tulane Sports Law Program, Tulane's Associate Provost for NCAA Compliance, and a fellow traveler in the podcast business, Between the Lines, a podcast about sports and law. Check it out. You really come to understand the nuances of this, but also, as Gabe just put very well, sort of the sweep of what's going on. Gabe, great to catch up with you. Thank you so much for making some time.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Gabe.
So let's turn now to the world of Major League Soccer and soccer across the world. David Beckham He's taken his talents to the executive suite. He's the co-owner of Inter Miami. That is one of the newest MLS franchises. I had the chance to catch up with him at the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg. And here we talk about the outlook for the MLS. His active ownership role in Miami, he really has, I think, quite literally rolled up his sleeves and gotten in there to try and fix some of the operations, the football operations, as it were, of this club to drive forward the MLS. And of course, we had to talk a little bit about the Super League that wasn't. This is obviously an issue very near and dear to his heart, having played at both Manchester United and Paris Saint-Germain during his professional career.
Life's pretty busy, I must admit, which I'm very thankful for. Obviously, there's a lot going on, obviously in London for me, and obviously in the States as well. You know, obviously I've been in Miami for the last 4.5-5 months, which I was very happy about and excited about, because obviously we've changed a few things within the team in Miami, and obviously bringing in the new coach and a new GM, and you know, a lot of things changing there. So it was a good time to be there, you know, to spend the amount of time that I did every single day in the club, working with the backroom staff, working with the players, working with our new coach, and obviously our new GM, Chris Henderson. And it was great to spend some time there. And then obviously heading back to the UK and being back in London now, and working on the business side and working with my team. So, yeah, there's a lot going on. So I'm very thankful for that. But, and the sun's out in London. So makes a change.
So we're going to talk about lots of different things, but given who is convening us, let's talk a little bit about the World Cup if we can, because you have the perspective that you do. The long march has begun toward Qatar next year, folks starting to qualify. What is it about the World Cup that galvanizes the world the way that it does? You have been there. You understand it as well as anyone.
You know, I think it's the general power of sport and the power of this game. You know, obviously football, soccer has been the biggest game, biggest sport in the world for a long, long time. And it unites and unifies people in a way that probably nothing does. You know, I think that sport does that in general, and I think that that's why I'm personally so lucky to have played a game that I've loved for so many years and since I was a baby. And I was lucky to be part of that and be a professional in that for a number of years. But I've also been really lucky to have played in 3 World Cups. I could have played in 4, but I got obviously injured. But, you know, to have been part of a World Cup, you know, as a young kid dreaming of playing on the same stage as these great countries and these great players, that was my dream as a kid, to represent my country and to hopefully play in a World Cup. And I was lucky enough to have done that. So I've seen how this sport unifies people, unites people. You know, it doesn't matter where you are in the world. It doesn't matter whether you speak that language. As soon as you're either on a football pitch, on a soccer pitch, in the stands, you know, there's something about this sport that just unites people in a way that nothing does. And it brings people together, you know, and I think that that's one of the things that I've always said about soccer, about sport, you know, being around the Olympics, being around World Cups. I've seen the way it changes people's lives, no matter what the world is going through, no matter what individuals are going through. When you're watching a soccer game, when you're watching the Olympics, nothing else matters for that amount of time. And that's why sport is so strong.
Yeah. And so let's take it back down to where you started, which is Miami, and sort of what you're doing there and how you sort of take your experience as a player. And now, as you alluded to, you're really rolling up your sleeves with this club. I mean, this is your life's work at the moment, at least. I mean, talk about being focused. Help me understand where the club and maybe where MLS is, because again, that's a journey you've been on from a player now to an owner and an executive.
I must admit, it's been an incredible journey. It's been longer than I ever expected it to be and to take to bring our team in Miami into the league. And it's taken a lot of hard work. It's taken a lot of stubbornness, which apparently I'm pretty stubborn, so my wife tells me. So it's taken a lot of hard work. But I knew the moment that I started my journey in the US, in the MLS with the LA Galaxy, I knew once I stepped away from the game that that was where my legacy lied in the sport in the US and globally, because I always believe that, you know, the MLS is a league that is growing and I wanted to be part of that. Back in 2007 when I joined, I saw that there was, it wasn't a challenge because I saw that there was real ambition within the league with Don Garber, with the people that were involved to grow this league and to make it one of the strongest leagues in the world. And it has a real chance and there's real opportunity there. You know, we've seen over the years the amount of teams and franchises that have come into this league. We've seen the players that have joined this league and there's still work to be done. But we've seen the numbers that are put with the franchises now, the numbers of how much these franchises are worth now, it's grown so dramatically in the last 5 to 10 years that it has a real opportunity. But the opportunity lies actually within the academy systems. That's what we want to produce. That's what we want to focus in. My focus within Inter Miami, yes, obviously we want to challenge on the field, in the MLS, on the big stage. But more importantly, for me, from day one, the academy is such an important part of that. And that's what I really focus on, because I want to be able to produce young players from Miami, South Florida, and all over the league. You know, every team wants to produce young, talented kids that come through their system into the MLS. And then, who knows, they go on and play for their countries. And that's the real opportunity. So it's been an incredible journey. And of course, we're still evolving. We're still a young team. We're a young franchise. So we're still learning. But we want to evolve quicker than, you know, than expected. So I honestly feel that the MLS is now being talked about all over Europe. And it has been for a number of years and globally. And also when I've traveled to certain places in Asia, wherever I've traveled to certain places in Europe, I see people walking down the street in a Miami jersey. I see people talking to me about Miami and saying, oh, we watched the game last night. So there is real interest globally in our team, but there's also real interest globally of the league. So, you know, it's moved on very quickly.
Yeah. It, you know, it's interesting to hear you talk about that decision because it was not an obvious one in 2007. And I think there's a parallel, I dare say, and keep me honest here, with your business ventures as well. You zigged in some ways when others zagged, or zagged when others zigged, however you want to put it, in the sense that historically, former athletes at the end of their playing careers tended to, you know, slap their names on a few things and take in some endorsements. You've chosen a more active path as really an owner, and not just in the sport, but I'm thinking about things you've done with electric cars, with CBD, you know, with esports even. Why is that? What was that decision for you to be an owner rather than an endorser?
Well, I think, you know, I've been very lucky to have had the career that I've had, you know, to have played for the clubs that I've played for, to have played in the cities and the countries that I've played in, and obviously have also been successful as well. So I think that really I take into my business world. And I think I'm very lucky, you know, I've been part of some great teams over the years, and I also have now a great team within my business, but that wasn't just luck, you know, that was obviously something that I built, you know, 5 years out from retiring, and that for me was an important part of my decisions going forward. You know, when I moved to the MLS and I was 31 years old, I was a Real Madrid player and people were critical maybe of, you know, that decision. But I realized that, yes, I'd played for Manchester United, I'd played for Real Madrid. I was moving as a Real Madrid player to play in a league that wasn't fully established at that point. But there was a real potential and opportunity there. And it wasn't just on the field, which my head automatically says, I want to be successful. I want to win trophies for the LA Galaxy. But more importantly, there was a bigger role as an ambassador for the league and for the sport in that country as well, in the US. And that's what really interested me. Yes, firstly, I wanted to win championships with the Galaxy. But then I wanted to be able to grow the sport. And I think that that's the same in my business world as well. You know, there are lots of opportunities, thankfully, that come into the office, that come into the team, that come to me. And it's about making the right decisions. And I have people around me and good people around me that help me make those right decisions. And yes, like you've said, you know, whether it's, you know, Lunaz, you know, obviously the electric car business that we've invested in, whether it's obviously the CBD, whether it's other things that we've gone into, we're making these decisions because, you know, I've got a lot of good people around me that, you know, that are working with me on this. And I'm very lucky within the business, you know, but it's come through hard work. And, you know, the way I look at my business is, I'm the first in the morning. I am the last to leave the office at night. And that's how I was as a player. You know, as a player, I was first in. I worked hard. I was last to leave. And I got that from Sir Alex Ferguson. You know, he was a manager that had been part of my life for a long time. But I also got that from my parents. You know, my mum and dad were working class. They worked hard. They still work now. So it was instilled in me from a very young age. And I was lucky that I joined a club with a coach that was like that. I then took that into my business. And I also have a team around me in the UK that also have that work ethic as well. So we're making the right decisions, hopefully, and doing the right things. But it also has to be enjoyable. I like to enjoy what I'm involved in. And that's what we do.
And it's interesting, and I would think you would find it interesting too, that this next generation of players, you know, maybe even the next two generations of players, this is a given in many ways, that they will build businesses around themselves. But that wasn't necessarily assumed when you came up. Is that fair to say?
100%. You know, obviously I was making decisions probably when I was playing that people were looking at and saying, you know, even probably my dad was looking at, you know, me doing the odd, you know, photo shoot for GQ or the odd photo shoot for Vogue and saying, yeah, but you're a footballer. So, you know, but I was making these decisions, not just because there was opportunities coming to me. And actually I enjoyed doing those kind of things as long as it didn't, you know, affect my playing career, as long as it didn't affect me on the pitch, then that was okay to do. But what I love about this next generation of players is, you know, we talk about obviously the social media. We talk about how important having a voice and being able to make these changes in the sports world, in the world in general. You know, these players like Marcus Rashford, like Raheem Sterling, you know, I think what they've done in the last 12 to 18 months has been incredible. They're using their fame, they're using their voice to change people's perspectives. And that's what I love about what they've been doing. You know, obviously, you know, a good friend of mine in LA now, you know, LeBron. You know, LeBron is using his real voice to change people and to help communities. And that's what I love about this next generation of sportsmen. You know, they're really using their kind of power to change.
Well, and it feels like fans are emboldened by that in many ways and are drawn to players who do that. And yes, people root for their teams, but, and I think you see this in your travels, increasingly they're attaching themselves to players who reflect the beliefs, their own belief systems in some ways.
Without a doubt. And that's why sport is so powerful. You know, we talk about it all the time. We talk about, obviously, the things that have happened over the last few months. You know, you talk about the Super League. You know, I'm not a politician. I don't like to talk about politics. You know, and when I talk about the game, when I talk about sport, I come at it as a fan. You know, I've been a fan since I can remember, from 4 or 5 years old, of sports and soccer. So I come at this particular subject as a fan. And when I see things that go on in the sport, I talk about it like I'm talking from a fan's perspective. And I think that as proof of what has happened over the last year, you know, when we don't see fans in the stand, when we don't see people, whether they're shouting for or against sportsmen, that has been missed. And that's why, you know, any decision going forward about, you know, whether it's a Super League, whether it's other leagues, whether it's things that happen in sports, that's why we've realised how important, and I knew this anyway as a ex-soccer player and as a fan, I know how important it is to have fans in the stadium and supporting. And that's why these decisions that get made in sport are so critical, because it changes people's lives and it changes people's perspective. And in sports and in competitions, you want a fair competition, simple as that. You want to be able to get into a competition on merit, not just because, you know, you're whatever club it is around the world. You know, you want to be there on merit. You want to be in the final of the Champions League on merit. You want to win the Champions League on merit. And I think that's what is important to really talk about.
So, yeah, there he is. Beckham, the man himself. This is a guy who is investing in EVs. He's investing in CBD. He was one of the OGs in that regard, Lynchy, in terms of seeing while he was a player that he needed to invest in himself as a business. He wanted to build an empire, and he has.
He certainly has. And he said that he knew when he came here, he knew his legacy would be in the United States, which surprised me because he was an international figure when he was signed by the LA Galaxy. And he said that his legacy would be in the United States. And now he is an owner. And as we said in the last segment, he joins a lot of people who have keen interest, as they say across the pond, keen interest in the MLS.
And so we'll see where soccer goes from here in this country. Obviously, the next World Cup, the next Olympics are going to be critical in breaking through. Miami is an interesting market in many ways, Bar. And, you know, as we think about this wide-ranging show that we've had, Bar, you know, what stuck out to you, even thinking about the Gabe Feldman interview?
Yes, that's definitely want to bring that up. And it's something that Gabe Feldman said. And he said that, first of all, you had a 9-0 unanimous ruling from the Supreme Court about the NCAA. And what he said was to get conservative judges to vote for labor, and especially what's going down in our society right now, say what you want, that's saying something. And that makes me wonder, and you kind of said it earlier, where is the future of the NCAA? Is this going to be the beginning of the end?
Yeah, I don't know where it really goes next. I mean, I think a lot has been laid bare when it comes to the NCAA and its toothiness, as it were, or lack of power. I mean, we've seen the Power Five conferences, you know, really command and control a lot of the economics. And now you have the players, you know, taking control of it. And, you know, Lynchy, if I think across what we heard from both of these guys, whether it's Gabe Feldman or David Beckham, this notion of a power shift, right, is really important. And some of the power shifting to the players, continuing to shift to the players, whether you're talking about amateur athletes in the NCAA, whether you're talking about professional athletes in the NBA or the MLS or in the English Premier League and beyond, but also to the fans. And I think social media has a big role in all of that. And it was interesting to hear Beckham, you know, kind of create that connective tissue between empowerment across the board. And certainly that was a theme that I took away from this week.
Well, the unmute button was hit in the year 2020 for social media by professional athletes. And now it's being unmute button is being hit with the college athletes and people who are listening. They heard them before. Now they're listening and they have no choice. Obviously, with this 9-0 a decision by the Supreme Court, which doesn't even affect name, image, and likeness, which is coming down the track July 1st. Things are going to change, and this is going to be a different world. I just worry about team morale on some teams when the quarterback goes and gets $25,000, but the offensive linemen are sort of sitting there and they get nothing. Does that cause a little dissension in among teams?
Yeah.
I would think it would.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see. Yeah, it is not going to be a straight line up, and it is not going to be it's going to be messy, I think, in the interim as all of this gets figured out, whether it's on the NCAA level. You know, Congress still can take this up, and I've spent a little bit of time with Chris Murphy, the U.S. Senator from Connecticut. He's the leading sponsor of this current NIL bill that's in Congress, which could do a lot to standardize, as it were, where we go from here.
My goal is to be the number one pick. That's something I've been dreaming of since a kid.
It feels better to be number one than number five.
I wear the number because of Mike.
We have a chance to go for three in a row.
Good numbers at a good time.
When I first started wearing that number, I was just happy and proud.
Bloomberg Business of Sports, the number of the week.
All right, with all that's going on, it's hard to predict what the number of the week is going to be. Lynchy tries to think like Barr. Scary thought. But here we go. Lay it on us.
This, we're going to keep in the theme of the NCAA ruling about the haves and the have-nots. And we talk about different locker rooms. Now, football players at Louisiana State University enjoy a $28 million facility, and that includes state-of-the-art locker room with sleep pods. Now, at the University of Oregon, Nike co-founder Philip Knight largely funded a 140,000-square-foot football facility at the cost of what?
I'll go a nice round 50.
I will see you and raise you $10 million. I'm going to go to $60 million.
Well, Lynchy's going up on stage. It is $68 million.
Wow.
And, I mean, that shows you the difference there. It's $28 million, that's doing something. But, you know, but $68 million is like, it's like Lynchy was saying. I wonder if they have, like, their own barber or whatever the heck is going on in there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's,
that's what Clemson has.
Yeah.
Clemson has a barbershop. I hope Oregon hasn't cut any varsity sports. If they have, shame on them.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to think about that arms race. And I thought Gabe Feldman made a really interesting point along these lines that, you know, from a facilities perspective and from an academic benefit perspective, so much of this is already baked in some ways. And he said it as he mentioned, he's like, you know, no dig against Alabama State, but you're not going to say, well, we're going to give you a nicer laptop than Nick Saban is, because Nick Saban has, you know, built this unbelievable facility in many ways. And it's the same at Clemson, same at University of Texas, clearly the same at University of Oregon. I mean, just incredible, the amount of money. And I do think, as Gabe Feldman said, that's part of what pushed this forward and pushed it to the point where you've got a 9-0 situation on the Supreme Court. And even what we heard from Marsha Blackburn and saying, you know, look, you look at this money and where it's all going, and none of it effectively, at least directly, is going to the players. So lots to look forward to, and you know we're going to be following this story very closely.
This is the Bloomberg Business of Sports show. We're here each and every week at the same time, plus online wherever you get your podcast. You can catch those Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. I'm Michael Barr on Twitter at Big Barr Sports.
And I'm Mike Lynch. You can follow me at LynchyWCBB.
And I'm Jason Kelly. Follow me on Twitter at Jason Kelly News.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio around the world.